Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, welcome to the latest episode of Talking France. This week, we'll get the lowdown on the European elections and why, in France at least, it's looking like it will be a resounding victory for Vladimir Putin. We'll also explain why southern France will likely see more deadly floods in future and try to understand why certain places in France are allowed casinos and why others, including Paris, are not. President Macron has angered yet more people in France this week with his latest reform around assisted dying. We'll look at what will change and who's angry about it. And is the most useful place in France your local post office? You can do far more there than just buy stamps, and we'll tell you exactly what. I'm Ben McPartland, and I'm honoured this week to be able to call on the help of the local France team over the next half an hour or so. As usual, Emma Pearson, Jen Mansfield, and John Litchfield will be doing most of the talking on this week's Talking France. Right, let's start off. French President Emmanuel Macron has come under fire this week. We've said those words quite a lot on this podcast, actually. This time, he's been blasted by French medical workers, political opponents, and the Catholic Church. It makes a change from farmers, teachers, or trade unions. The criticism all stems from a draft bill set to be presented to Parliament in May that would allow assisted dying for certain terminally ill patients. Death can no longer be a taboo issue and subject to silence. Those were the words of French PM Gabriel Attal. Macron has long promised a reform on this sensitive issue, Emma, and given the opposition it's provoked so far, it looks like some difficult months lie ahead for him and his government.
Yeah, so we did actually mention this in our New Year episode of the podcast. Do you remember we did that special one where we looked ahead to what was happening in France in 2024? At that time, the timetable was a bit vague, but we do now know that a bill will be brought before Parliament at the end of May, and that will be to reform France's laws on assisted dying. And we also know now in detail what's actually being proposed, which is essentially to bring France more in line with its neighbours like Belgium or the Netherlands when it comes to giving people the power to end their own lives. And this was finally announced by Emmanuel Macron over the weekend, and he did it in a joint interview with two newspapers, the Catholic paper La Croix, which is against it, as you would expect, and the left-leaning daily Libération, which has been quite a strong supporter of assisted dying. And I mean, yes, as you said, there has been some opposition to it. However, I think we should point out that polling suggests that the majority of French people are in favour of the changes, quite strongly, in fact, between 70 and 80% of people, depending on what polls you look at. France's Medical Ethics Council has also supported the idea, and a majority of doctors do back the proposal.
Okay, so the actual bill will be put forward towards Parliament in May. What do we know so far about what Macron is actually proposing?
Well, we have quite a bit of the detail now, and basically what's being suggested is that a patient will be able to make a request to a medical professional for help to die. And in order to be considered patients, they must be adults, they must be in full control of their judgment, and they must be suffering from an incurable or life-threatening illness in the short to medium term and whose pain cannot be relieved. So once that request is made, the doctor must consider it within 15 days. And if it is granted, the permission remains valid for up to 3 months. And if the doctor refuses that, then the patient has the right to get a second opinion and kind of appeal that decision. But if it's successful, a lethal substance can then be prescribed to the patient, and they can either take it themselves or have someone administer it if they're physically not able to do so, for example, someone who is paralysed. And the person who's assisting them can either be a medical professional or they can be a friend or a relative. And it can be administered in the patient's own home or in a more medical setting like a clinic or a nursing home or a care home where you might be living. Under 18s and patients suffering from either psychiatric or neurodegenerative conditions, so dementia, would not be eligible for this. So the bill itself will be presented to Parliament in late May, and MPs will be given a free vote on it. And it follows this really lengthy consultation process. It's been almost 2 years in total, including a citizens' council, which concluded that overall there is support in France for legalising assisted dying.
Okay, now I mentioned the criticism he's come in for from opponents, medical workers and the church. Just sum up their arguments for us, Emma.
Well, mean, some of the reaction has been, as you would expect, the Catholic Church is strongly against it, as it always is. France's Medical Ethics Council, they were part of the early consultation process, and they came out in favour of the idea, albeit with strict controls. And as I said, the polling suggests the wider public is in favour of it. But an association that represents both nurses and charities working in the palliative care sector have come out against the plan. And they basically say that palliative care services in France are underfunded and inadequate. And what they fear is that people will end up opting for assisted dying when they don't really want to, but what they want to do is avoid a sort of painful and undignified death without proper palliative care services. And it is true that although the assisted dying proposals themselves are very precise, as I just went through, there's another announcement of extra money for palliative care services, up to €1 billion. And that's a lot more vague as to what that actually is going to involve.
Okay, now apart from the public appearing to be behind it, as you mentioned, Emma, the bill has won support from members of Right to Die groups in France, with one of them saying, knowing that French law will finally allow us to avoid a situation where we're not yet dead, but not really alive anymore is very important. Just remind us exactly, what is the law at the moment around assisted dying in France?
Well, at present, French law doesn't allow any form of assisted dying. It only allows what they call deep and continuous sedation for patients who are terminally ill. It is, however, not illegal to travel abroad or to help someone else to travel abroad to access assisted dying. And a fairly significant number of French people do this, usually going to neighbouring Belgium in order to end their lives.
So would this reform then bring France more into line with neighbours around Europe?
It would, yes. Yeah. So both Belgium and the Netherlands allow assisted suicide of patients who've clearly expressed a wish to die. And the French proposals would broadly replicate the laws and conditions that exist in Belgium and the Netherlands, with the exception that suicide would not be available to under 18s or dementia patients. And they are available to those groups in Belgium and the Netherlands. Switzerland is perhaps the most famous example of a country that allows assisted suicide, and they have organisations such as Dignitas and Exit, which are open to foreigners who want to travel to Switzerland to end their lives. And actually, both Spain and Portugal have recently passed laws to allow assisted dying under strict conditions, which are somewhat similar to the French proposal. Most of the rest of European countries, they don't allow assisted dying, but they do allow what they call passive euthanasia, which is basically the withdrawal of life-preserving treatments, such as taking people off a ventilator or allowing patients to express their opposition to any form of treatment, even feeding. Italy hasn't actually changed its law, but its highest court has recently ruled that it is not a crime to help someone die if their suffering is intolerable.
Thanks, Emma. Let's bring in our French politics expert, John Litchfield, who joins us on the line now from Normandy. John, does Macron really need to push this reform through in France, or will it be a fraught few months for him ahead?
It's difficult to know, you know, because although there's a large support for the idea, I think 70-80% in polls I've seen, for the idea of doing something to make it possible for people to make a decision not to continue their lives if they're threatened, if they're essentially dying anyway, and if they're in enormous suffering. What Macron's chosen to do is kind of strange in a way. He's tried to, in a way, square the circle of what's already the law in Belgium and Switzerland and other countries. In a sense, he's avoided the phrase right to die. He refuses to use that. He's talking about assisted dying or aid to dying. He seems to have annoyed both the people on the sort of pro-life Catholic point of view that you don't interfere with the course of life at all. It's sort of a morally wrong thing to do. And also not really satisfied the people who think there is a good humanist argument for changing the present law, which is very confused. It's difficult to know because we don't know what the law is going to say yet. All we have is Macron's own interview with, interestingly, with a Catholic newspaper and a left-wing newspaper, Le Croix and Libération this week, in which he announced he was finally going to do this. Until we know the details of what's in the law, it'd be difficult to say. I suspect it will go through the parliament, but I suspect this is only the beginning of continued argument about this, and this will turn out to be another stage towards something a bit stronger, and that it isn't really necessarily an answer to what is a terrible and very fraught problem.
If you're British and living in France, you will know that banking is not as straightforward as in Britain. Depending on your situation, there may be special banking or administrative requirements. Often it can be confusing. Whether managing a move to live and work in France, purchasing a holiday home or retiring, Britline can help. Founded in 1999 as part of Crédit Agricole Normandie, Britline's advisors can help you establish a new life in France, all in simple, plain English. To find out more, head to britline.com. Now, earlier this week, southern France experienced intense rainfall and subsequent flooding. It led to rivers overflowing and submerging, bridges, two houses collapsing in a landslide, and unfortunately, several deaths. Jen, just explain what happened here.
So at the time of recording, six people were confirmed dead after the floods, including one child. And of those people who died, five were in the Gard department and one was in the Hérault department. As for the rest of France, coming out of winter, the country had recorded an average rainfall surplus of around 12%, according to the weather channel La Chaîne Météo. And in many places in France, grounds are just saturated with rainwater, making it more likely that flooding will occur. The north of France has also experienced a lot of flooding this year, especially in the Pas-de-Calais department. Some villages, like Étain, have flooded more than four times since November. And recently, the French government decided to classify 82 municipalities in the department as being in a state of natural disaster, which is necessary for insurance claims.
Okay, so certain parts of France have seen a heck of a lot of rain this winter. What does it mean for the spring going forward? Can we expect more flooding?
Well, so some parts of France have stayed dry, like the Pyrénées-Orientales department, which is along the Mediterranean coast. And that actually has several communes that are still on drought alert. But yeah, for the majority of France, mainly in the north and the west, it's been a very rainy winter, which has been good for the groundwater tables, but has led to a lot of flooding and destruction in some places. As for the rest of spring, Météo France recently published its seasonal prediction, and they focused mostly on the warmer weather. So they are forecasting that seasonal temperatures are going to be above the usual averages, which is in line with what we saw during the winter, too. The other weather station, La Chaîne Météo, forecasts that the country will see wet weather in the short term, especially in the western and southern parts, and that these areas would likely see precipitation at slightly higher than average levels. But they also predicted that come May, the weather is going to start to become hot and dry across much of France. They did say that there could be some storms during the month of May, and that these would most likely be located in the south and near high altitude areas like the Pyrenees and the Alps mountain ranges.
Now, the south and the southeast in particular have seen devastating and deadly flooding in the past. In 2020, Storm Alex led to the death of 10 people in catastrophic floods, and 5 years previously to that, in October 2015, the so-called Episode Méditerranéen in an area stretching from Mandelieu to Antibes left 20 dead. What is it about southeast France, Jen? Why do they seem to get so many intense storms?
Well, there are a couple of explanations. So generally, storms have been intensifying in southeastern France. Meteorologists found that there has been a 20% increase in storm intensity between 1961 and 2015. A large part of that has to do with its location, but climate change is playing a role too. The gist is that the warmer the air, the more humidity it can contain, which increases the potential for rain. So the southeast is getting more humid air, largely because of the warm water evaporating off of the sea. And the southeast tends to get these intense thunderstorms because it's home to a lot of unstable clouds. So usually the area near the sea is low pressure because of humid air, but the areas near the mountains and at altitude have colder air. So that means that you have a lot of conflict between the clouds, and that creates storms. And the storms kind of stay in one place because there's not a lot of wind, which means you end up getting a huge dumping of rain in one go,
which causes these violent and devastating flash floods. But it's not just the weather to blame, Jen.
No, humans bear some of the blame too. So the Riviera region has become more and more popular for people to move to over the past few decades. There have been more roads, railways, buildings being built, and the water is blocked by concrete and asphalt, which means it cannot be absorbed in the same way that it would naturally in green spaces. This makes it easier for flash flooding to happen on streets and roadways and for the rivers to overflow. But some communities are taking action to try and prevent future disasters. So after flooding in 2015 that destroyed 26 houses in the town of La Brague, local authorities decided to put 10 million euro toward widening the riverbed so that it could absorb more water and flood naturally and safely. There have been other efforts to widen and deeper rivers in the area. And even though they might not stop flooding entirely, these sustainable prevention measures would give people more time to react during a storm.
Emma, am I right in saying, I think this time last year, we were talking about the lack of water, the lack of rainfall in France, but it really has been a wet few months in France. Seine has even been overflowing in Paris.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the homeless camps had to be evacuated from the Seine when the river came over. I got a video the other day from a mate in Charente of what looked like an enormous lake, but is actually just fields that are underwater. So it's, you really notice it if you're, even if you're on a train or whatever, you just look out the window, there's like water everywhere.
Yeah, it really has been. Heavy rain feels like for months. Right, guys, let's move on to our next segment, which begins with a bike ride. Do you want to hear about it?
Yes.
Yes, always.
All right. I went on a bike ride on Saturday morning with a couple of bikey mates. They were dressed in Lycra. I wasn't, just for the record. And we headed up through this banlieue of northern Paris through Saint-Ouen. Have you ever been there?
Yes.
Big market up there?
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, fabulous flea market.
Yeah, good, really lively place. And we ended up at this place. There was a big lake and there was a huge casino. And it felt like suddenly we were miles out of Paris, yet we were still in the kind of banlieue. It was a place called Angers-les-Bains. And this casino got me thinking, or got us all thinking, why was there a casino here? And he said something about it was all to do with Napoleon passing a law that any town with Les Bains on the end could have a casino. Was he right?
So he was half right. The Napoleon bit was right. And this follows the usual, if you want to guess why something is the way it is in France, it's either the revolution or Napoleon rule. Mm-hmm. In the early 1800s, Napoleon wanted to decrease illegal gambling. So he created rules around casinos and said that they could only be located in specific touristic areas like coastal resort towns and spa villages. And a lot of those spa villages tend to be named with Les Bains at the end. But these aren't the only places where casinos are allowed today. So over time, that has changed. In 1907, popular mountain resorts became eligible to open casinos. And in 1988, the French government loosened the regulations again, making it so that casinos could be opened in towns with more than 500,000 inhabitants.
Paris has got more than 500,000 inhabitants, Jen, but does it have a casino?
So Paris is a bit different. In 1919, France banned casinos within a 100-kilometer radius of the capital to combat gambling addictions, and that rule has stuck around. However, there was an exception that was allowed in 1931, which led to the creation of one casino in the Paris region, which happens to be located in Angers-les-Bains.
You're calling it Angers-les-Bains. Yeah, you're right. I was calling it Angers-les-Bains. But that's exactly where I ended up, Jen. It's about 10 kilometers to the north of Paris. You can go there by bike, as I did, or you can just get a train from Gare du Nord. It takes about 15 minutes if you want to fritter away some money. Or just avoid the casino, you can go on the boat on the lake there. It's beautiful. Jen, there's been some recent reforms, have there not, that could see more casinos opening in other parts of France in future?
Yeah, so France currently has 202 casinos. And actually in December, French lawmakers voted in favor of allowing more exceptions to where casinos can be located in an effort to reduce territorial inequalities regarding the opening of casinos. The exemptions were specifically aimed at areas that have an equestrian heritage. So these might be classified as historic and places with a modern connection to horse racing, stud farms, or influential equestrian events. And then they also allowed some exceptions for communes that are part of an intermunicipal association, so intercommunalité, with more than 100,000 people located in départements along France's border. So you'd call these the départements frontaliers in French. These places are also going to be allowed to apply to open a casino as long as there has not already been one authorized in that département at the date of application. It's worth mentioning that any new casino in France does have to be authorized by France's Ministry of Interior. And even with all of these exceptions, there's still around a third of French departments that don't have any casino in them.
You been to any casinos in France, Emma?
No, but I have been to the supermarket. Maybe we should be clear that there is a supermarket chain called Casino. But you can't do any gambling in there. You can just buy cheese and stuff.
I spent 8 hours once at the Deauville Casino.
Did you win?
I walked away after 8 hours with a profit of about 15 euros. Profit, I've probably spent about 150 on drinking.
House always wins, Ben. Yeah, house always wins.
Should have known. But you always need a passport to get in, which always surprises me. All right. You're not gambling types, you two, then?
I have a flutter on the horses every now and again.
Okay.
I just base it on like which horse looks pretty.
Yeah. Thanks, Jen, for that information on casinos. I reckon our listeners will be flooding to find the nearest casino near them. Just in case anyone isn't aware or maybe forgot, we do actually have elections in France this year, and they're pretty important ones too. Well, they're important to President Emmanuel Macron and indeed to his fierce rival, Marine Le Pen, because they could give a sign as to who will win the next presidential election in 2027. Emma, tell us a bit more about these elections.
Yeah, so if you read French media in the last couple of weeks, you'll have seen a lot of talk about politicians being tête de liste, the head of the list. And this refers to the European elections in June. And over the last couple of weeks, most of the major parties in France have now finalised their list of candidates and they've officially launched their campaigns, which is kind of why we're talking about this now. And yeah, although these elections, they don't directly affect French domestic politics, they are still considered important by the big French parties. And in a lot of ways, they do act as a kind of proxy or even a trial run for French domestic elections.
Okay, let's start with the practicalities. When are the elections and how do they work?
Okay, so in France, polling day will be on Sunday, June the 9th. Although in some of the French overseas departments, because of the time difference, it's on June the 8th. So places like French Polynesia, French Guiana, Guadeloupe, Martinique, Saint-Barthélemy, Saint-Martin and Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon. They'll be the day before. Unlike the French elections, where you have two rounds of voting, there's just one polling day this time, and we're voting for members of the European Parliament, or MEPs. France will this time have 81 seats in the European Parliament. It used to have 74, but it got a few extra seats after Brexit because some of the UK's former seats were shared out among other countries.
Right, you said there we're voting. Who can actually vote in these elections if you live in France?
Well, French residents can only vote in the European elections if they are citizens of an EU country. So obviously anyone who has French citizenship, but also any French residents who are citizens of another EU country, such as Ireland. So as an Irishman, you can vote, Ben, but Jen and I cannot.
Right, okay.
And if you're a new EU citizen or you haven't voted in European elections before, you'll probably need to register to vote. And you can start off just by searching the electronic electoral roll to see if you're on it. And if not, you register in your local area by the deadline of May 1st. And the way that these elections work is quite interesting. Well, I think it's interesting. Maybe you need to be a massive nerd like me. But anyway, I think it's interesting. So France, like most of its EU neighbours, they elect their MPs through direct proportional representation via what they call the list system, so that parties get the number of MEPs equivalent to their share of the overall vote. So if you're in your polling booth as an elector, you just vote for the party that you want. And then that party in advance has created a numbered list of candidates. And the higher up the list those candidates are, the more likely they are to become MEPs. So let's say, for example, that Marine Le Pen's party wins 50% of the overall vote. France, as we said, has 81 MEPs. So that means that her party gets to send 40 MEPs, half of that total. And they would be the candidates listed 1 to 40 on the list, while the candidates who are 41 or below end up missing out. And that's why this tête de liste thing that we were talking about is important, because if you're named head of the list or number one on the list of any decent-sized party, then you're virtually guaranteed to be becoming an MEP in June.
Okay, nerdy but quite important information there, Emma.
That's me, nerdy but important.
Nerdy but important. We do have more information if you're interested in knowing who can vote and how to register on our website. I'll include the link in the show notes and in the podcast article. Let's bring in John Litchfield again now to get his views on the European elections. John, in your column for the Local France this week, you stated a clear winner is emerging in France for the European elections, and that's Vladimir Putin. What did you mean by that, John?
Well, it's meant to be a little provocative, but in the sense that the latest very sort of wide poll of more than 11,000 voters this week in Le Monde, the Rassemblement National, led in this case by Jordan Bardella, the effective number two of the far-right, Marine Le Pen's far-right party, is 13 points ahead of the government in opinion polling for the 9th of June. And essentially, it is extraordinary that a country which is 70% pro the war, or pro the support for Ukraine, is more than 70% pro the European project, according to this same poll, is going to vote so overwhelmingly for a party which is, despite its denials, essentially anti-European and has had a huge reputation for plenty of evidence of having been financially and politically very tied up with Vladimir Putin over the years. So if that poll stands, it can, I think, be said to be a victory for Putin, which is exactly why the government feels its best chances of doing better and never win, but it could certainly reduce the Le Pen lead in this election, is to make it into a referendum, not on Macron, which it is now, but a referendum on Putin, a referendum on the Ukraine war.
John, what's at stake for France in these European elections? We haven't had an election for a couple of years. These are quite significant for France.
I think they're significant for that reason, Ben, in the sense that this is the first national midterm election, if you like to use an American term, since the parliamentary elections, just after the presidential elections 2 years ago. So, you know, essentially all governments suffer in midterm elections. Since then, we've had the pension reform, we've had inflation, we've had all kinds of reasons why people are down on Macron. So it's not surprising that he's seen it being so badly in this poll. But to be doing as badly as he is, only 18% of people willing to vote for the Macron alliance. You know, it's serious in European terms because the far right is likely to do quite well across Europe, and it may make the European Parliament essentially unable to deliver any kind of serious European policies in the years ahead. But in purely French terms, if you had that much of a victory for Le Pen or for Le Pen's party in this election, doesn't actually shape what's going to happen in 2027, but psychologically it prepares the ground for yet more for a Le Pen victory. I've never myself been prepared to say that Le Pen is likely to win in 2027, but as big a victory as this does bring that nearer. It makes it more possible just by it essentially removes the taboo in the minds of French people on the idea of a big victory for the Rassemblement National. So you can see why Macron is desperate to turn it around, using everything he can. It's not unreasonable, I think, to use the fact that Le Pen's party is essentially a pro-Putin party in its recent history against it in this election, remind people of what that party is. I mean, it gets by on disguising its real policies and intentions. Why not point it out to people? Whether that's going to work, I'm not sure.
New legislation in France to tackle climate change is changing the way you let or sell properties. From next year, you will need to provide an energy performance diagnostic certificate with a rating above a G grade to potential tenants or buyers. If your property is modern, this won't be a problem. However, bringing older properties up to that energy efficient standard could be complex and costly. Luckily, there is help available. To help you plan your renovation, Britline, the French bank with British thinking, has created a handy online guide. Their tool will help you estimate your diagnostic grade, identify any grants or loans you may be eligible for, and identify local tradesmen. Head to britline.com, where in their help and resources section, you will find several blogs on the subject. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the show about the most useful place in France. For me, it always was Decathlon. But Emma, you're going to try and change my mind and suggest that there is a more useful place in France than Decathlon. Is it the post office? I know you can get money out there and you can buy stamps there. Anything else you can do?
Yeah, you can do absolutely loads of things. And I must say, some of these came as news to me when I started researching this question, which came in from a reader of The Local. So yeah, you can have a postie checkup on elderly or vulnerable relatives. La Poste has a scheme called Veiller sur mes parents, which means like keep an eye on my parents. Mm. But it doesn't just have to be for parents. It can be for anyone. And it can be organised and paid for from anywhere in the world. And it allows for people to arrange for postal workers to drop in on elderly or vulnerable people up to six times a week and just check that they're okay. And the theory being that the facteurs, the postal staff, they're kind of out and about on their rounds anyway, and they often get to know their customers. They might have a chat with them. They might even have a coffee with their regulars, or sometimes a drink. Have you ever seen the film Bienvenue les Ch'tis?
It's a film, no.
Okay, it features a guy working for La Poste up in the north of France, and he kind of goes out on a trial run, and he's on a round delivering people, and everybody invites him in, and he has a little drink with everyone and ends up very drunk and messy. It's very funny.
Nice.
Postmen are not supposed to drink on their rounds, I should point out.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, to do with the fact that they know people in their community. And, you know, you can also set up other home care schemes like meal deliveries, medicine deliveries through La Poste. And people who are elderly or ill can also arrange for the postal worker to just call at their house and pick up any letters or parcels that they need delivering.
Okay, what about younger people who don't need the postman to check up on them? Anything for them?
Yeah, if you need an ID check, like if you need your ID verifying for official purposes, then La Poste staff, they can do that. They can do it in person at the post office. But there is also an app created by La Poste called Identité Numérique that allows you to verify your ID in order to log into official websites, such as the tax website. It's basically just like an enhanced security check that allows you to log in faster and more securely. When you set it up, you need to upload a copy of your ID, and you also need to do like an on-screen video verification. The process of setting it up is a bit complicated, but once you've done it, you get a fast track securely to official sites. But one thing I should point out is that you need either a French passport, or if you're not French, you need a multi-year residency card in order to do it. So as we discovered when we set it up, Jen cannot access it. It's a bit of a sore point. Don't mention it.
Interesting. You've reminded me now, you know, we've done this similar story for our other websites, looking at what you can do in Austrian post offices and Swiss post offices. You know, in an Austrian post office, you can change your soda maker cylinder.
That's, I did not know
that's pretty original. Most of Austria's postal offices, you can exchange your empty CO2 cylinders. And in Switzerland, you know what you can do? You can get the bus. Switzerland has post buses, 2,400 vehicles covering a network of 936 lines, 17,000 kilometers all around the rural roads.
That's amazing.
In France, anything to do with letters that's useful?
I mean, you can send letters, obviously. It's a post office.
Yeah.
They do have this quite useful service for, like, formal letters and also...
Those pesky formal letters.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you kind of need to write a sort of formal letter for in France for quite a lot of processes. Yeah. So, like, if you need to supply an attestation or a déclaration sur l'honneur, for example, or you need to send a formal letter if you want to cancel a subscription or resign your job.
Mm.
And they're quite, you know, you need sort of quite formal French, so it's hard for foreigners. But the La Poste website has all these different model letters on their website, so you can just sort of put in your details and it'll create for you a formal letter in the correct, very fancy and mellifluous French. And the other thing that they have, which is quite handy, is an email version of a lettre recommandée. Mm. A lettre recommandée is like tracked mail. And again, you need to send this type of letter for all sorts of formal processes like cancelling a subscription or closing down an account with a utility company. And previously, you always had to send like an actual physical letter through the tracked letter service. But these days, you can send an online version via La Poste's website. It basically works like an email, but if you use the La Poste's online lettre recommandée service, it has the same legal status as a tracked letter.
Mm, okay, now just clear something up for me. I saw recent headlines that you can go in post offices to try on clothes. What's this about?
Well, yeah, this is a pilot scheme, so it's only in a few places at the moment, and it's not just any old clothes. It's intended to help online shoppers. So the theory is that you pick up parcels of clothes that you've ordered online in La Poste, and then you can go straight into the changing room and try them on. And if they don't fit, you parcel them up and send them back rather than having to make a separate trip to the post office.
Jen, you put
your thumbs up. On, though.
Well, I think that sounds great because, I mean, I try not to order a lot of stuff online, but sometimes, you know, I order something online and it doesn't fit and it's a pain to go to the post office and take it back.
Yeah, I think that's a cracking idea. Look, we've established that post offices are really useful. I fear as though, are we making people jealous who might have just lost their local post office in France? Are they closing down a lot like in other countries?
Yes, you know, as we see in many other countries in Europe, there's been an ongoing reorganization, as they call it, of postal services in France. And it's reflecting that there's been a roughly 50% drop in the number of letters sent over the last decade. People send fewer letters. And that has meant two things. It's meant closing post offices or just reducing opening hours of post offices. And it also means reforming the way that postal staff work. And in a lot of places, they're not super happy about these reorganizations. So we have seen quite a lot of postal strikes. So you might not be getting your mail. There has been a big drop, yes. Yes, in the number of post offices since 2015. Around 15,000 post offices have closed. Some departments have lost up to 30% of their post offices.
Wow, brutal.
Yeah, it's a lot. But everywhere in France has seen at least some level of closure. Although you maybe feel the loss more in a rural area where the post office might be one of the few services in the village, the closures are actually much more concentrated in urban areas. And in fact, it's now the most sparsely populated French département, which is Creuse, Corrèze and Lozère, that have the highest number of post offices per person, while people in urban areas have a lot fewer services per person. What you tend to see in towns and cities is the closing down of the smaller or suburban post offices, maybe replacing them just with a counter in a shop so that you can do simple things like buy stamps. But if you've got a more complicated request, you'll probably have to travel to the big post office, which will be in another part of town. But what they have set up is what they call the La Poste Relais service. And that's where you can get parcels delivered to other businesses that have signed up to be a collection point. They tend to be in like mini markets or convenience stores. And personally, I think they're way more practical because they usually have much more extended opening hours. So you can just pick up your parcel at your convenience rather than having to fit in around the opening hours of the post office, which usually are not open in evenings or weekends.
Thanks, Emma. Really good information there. And that's your lot, I'm afraid, listeners. That brings us to the end of this week's episode of Talking France. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Jen. Thanks, John. We'll be back with more talking points in next week's episode.